the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Are we facing a religious generation gap? That's the question asked by the Wall Street Journal. That's what we're going to be talking about here today on the Albert Mohler Program. This is a really interesting report. It's an angle a lot of people may not have noticed, but if you're living where I live, doing what I do, and if you're around a lot of Christian young people today, you're going to see this phenomenon. You're going to find out that there are a lot of Christian young people who are more committed to Christ, to Christian convictions, to a Christian way of life, to serious Christian devotion than are their parents. In some cases, their parents are just flat out scared. In some cases, the parents are also very secular. In other cases, they're just more, let's just say, tepidly Christian. In any case, they are perplexed by their own adolescence, their own young people, high school students, and especially high school and college students, and their seriousness with which they're taking the Christian faith. We're only talking about that today, and I'm going to tell you about some of the folks who have contacted me even since I published my article overnight last night about this phenomenon. There's time for you to go and take a look at the article. You can go to albertmohler.com. You'll find the article there in my weblog, Religion's Generation Gap. And we'll also be talking about it. You can also go directly from my article to the link at the Wall Street Journal, where you will find a very fascinating report. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We're going to be talking about religion's generation gap, and it will be fun and incisive to hear from both sides of this generational divide. Maybe some parents and some young people who'd like to join the discussion. Again, the number 877-893-8255. First, to review some other issues in the news and other issues of importance, I have just posted an article just in the last few minutes at my website about something that I felt duty-bound to mention, to address. And I have to tell you, it's the kind of thing that is a little more difficult to address simply because being honest about one's supposed allies is often very difficult. We are in a battle. It's defined in many ways as a culture war that's overly simplistic. But nonetheless, we do know there are very significant lines of debate in this country over basic issues of ranging from everything from human sexuality and human dignity all the way to ideas about economics and politics and all the rest. Whether you want to call it a culture war or anything else, there are partisans on both sides. One of the most articulate of those partisans is Ann Coulter, author, radio talk show host, media personality. She is a woman of many gifts and many right ideas. She has so often been an eloquent spokeswoman for conservative convictions. She can be a very prophetic critic of secular liberalism. Unfortunately, she can also be her own worst enemy. Last week, she addressed the American Conservative Union's Political Action Committee, and there she made a deplorable reference to former Senator John Edwards of North Carolina. Now, I'm going to read you her comments, but I'm going to leave off the word. This is what she said. I was going to have a few comments on the other Democratic presidential candidate, John Edwards, but it turns out you have to go into rehab if you use the word, insert a blank there, so kind of an impasse, can't really talk about Edwards. Now, that word is one I'm not going to use on this program. It's cited at my website in the statement directly quoted from her speech, but it's a slur against homosexuals, and you pretty much know what it is. Some people are calling it the new F word. It's an awful, awful word, and we all know what it is. It's inexcusable that Ann Coulter would use that word about anyone. In this case, about Democratic former Senator John Edwards, who is, of course, a candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination. Ann Coulter's unrepentant about the slur. She says, "I'm so ashamed, I can't stop laughing." She also added, "Come on, it was a joke. I would never insult gays by suggesting that they are like John Edwards. That would be mean." Well, mean? Well, let's face the facts. Ann Coulter has turned herself into the evil queen of mean. She has lowered herself to embarrassing theatrics and crude humor. More seriously, she does not mean all insults as a joke, and she can't plausibly claim this. In a recent book, she attacked some of the 9/11 windows as publicity hounds, attacking them personally. She has a tawdry record of cheap shots, crude slurs, and indefensible personal attacks. Conservative institutions cannot afford any association with this kind of language or attack. Let's face it, the issues are far too serious to be treated in this manner. And the very convictions Ann Coulter often defends are now sullied by association with her. referring to John Edwards by using a word meant to demean homosexuals? What in the world was she thinking? Ann Coulter has herself never been married. John Edwards, on the other hand, has been married for almost 30 years to his wife, Elizabeth. Together, they have had four children, Wade, Kate, Emma Claire, and Jack. Wade died in a tragic car accident at age 16, throwing the Edwards family into a grief that often tears spouses apart. But instead of being torn apart, John and Elizabeth Edwards went on to produce two more children, Emma Claire and Jack. And John Edwards more recently stood by his wife through her fight with breast cancer, and there's never been an associated scandal with their long marriage. No scandal has been associated with this couple. Now, I oppose John Edwards' political platform, but I cannot oppose or condemn John Edwards, the man, the husband, and the father. I do not want to see him elected president of the United States, but this has everything to do with his political positions, not with his personal life. I do not appreciate his crude oversimplification of the challenges that face our nation, but I must oppose any crude talk about John Edwards, the man. So why would Ann Coulter use that word? Let's face it. But the even more troubling question to me is why would any in her conservative audience laugh when she used the word? There's nothing even remotely funny about that word in any context. It's meant to hurt when boys use it in the locker room, and it was meant to hurt when Ann Coulter used it when speaking to a conservative audience. It demeans homosexuals and should be banned from any acceptable discourse. How can homosexuals think anything but the worst of a movement that would laugh at the use of this word? How can we think any better of ourselves if we stand by and let it happen? There's going to be an interesting debate over Ann Coulter's comments, and this is not the first time she's gotten into hot water. She was dismissed twice by one news network for using this kind of language and for the approach she has taken in public discourse. You know, this is another reminder to us that even though there are some who agree with us on the issues, we cannot afford the association. And I want to tell you one of the least seemly responses I'm hearing from conservatives. I'm hearing conservatives say, look, liberals do it too. I'm hearing people say, look, just look at the left and look at the kind of language they use. Look at some of the slogans they use. And you know what? They have to answer for that. We have to answer for what we tolerate and for what we applaud. We are responsible for our own laugh track. And yes, our laughs sometimes condemn us. We are living in interesting times. Last night on the Discovery Channel, they broadcast the much ballyhooed documentary, The Lost Tomb of Jesus. We talked about it a great deal last week. I was on Larry King Live on CNN Monday night of last week debating this issue. I'm glad to say that what I had hoped for has happened. Number one, the wheels have been knocked off this vehicle. By the time the documentary aired, they were already in big trouble. Why would I say that? Because it's not just conservative evangelical Christians who are attacking the credibility of this particular documentary. It's also the mainstream media. The New York Times art section, Saturday, March 3, 2007. This is the day before the program aired. Alessandra Stanley, who is not a woman of the conservative side, she hardly can be accused of being a conservative critic. She wrote her review of the documentary. She says this: The Lost Tomb of Jesus is enjoyable mostly because it is scripted like a cryptological treasure hunt and centered on the Indiana Jones-ish personality of Simcha Yakubovich, an Israeli-born filmmaker based in Toronto whose recent documentary, The Exodus Decoded on the History Channel, argued that the Jews really did flee Egypt by the parted sea. In The Lost Tomb of Jesus, Mr. Yakubovich is once again trying to prove that the Bible is not wrong, just a bit misunderstood. But this is where she really goes in for the kill. She says this: His logic can seem circular to the point of fallacious. The idea of finding Jesus' tomb might not seem so outlandish if we could locate tombs belonging to his followers, Mr. Yakubovich says to his crew. Soon after, he adds, although we found ourselves in the wrong tomb, perhaps these finely crafted ossuaries so close to the Talpiot tomb are somehow connected to Jesus or his followers. Now, this is where she really goes in. Listen, this is her words here. She says, in other words, because this is Jesus' tomb, the nearby tombs are likely those of his followers. Because those nearby tombs are likely those of his followers, this must be the tomb of Jesus. She identifies their circular reasoning. If you are not watching the documentary carefully, you will not realize they're talking over themselves. But I love the way she closes. And again, this is the New York Times. This isn't Christianity Today. It's not World Magazine. It's not the Albert Mueller Program. This is the New York Times. She says this: all kinds of touchy issues are raised by the Lost Tomb of Jesus, which could someday lead the Discovery Channel to wish it had left the Talpiot tomb unfound. Yes, the Discovery Channel did nothing to enhance its own credibility when they broadcast last night The Lost Tomb of Jesus. And it's fascinating to see the New York Times point that out. The LA Times also did an op-ed piece by Charlotte Allen. She started her article this way: Easter is around the corner, and so it must be time for a dramatic revelation that will blow the lid off Christianity. Yeah, right. Once again, year after year, just about this time of year, you have to get ready for some representation in the mainstream media of a supposed scandal that's going to change the way we understand everything about Christianity. Right. Buckle your seatbelts. It's going to come every single year. Is there a religious generation gap? Are we looking at children now more conservative, more convictional, more involved than their parents? We're going to talk about it, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. So what does happen when teenage children are more devout than their parents? The Wall Street Journal recently addressed that question in a major report published last week. Reporter Catherine Rossman explains, and I'm quoting from her story here, an increasing number of teens and young adults who were raised in non-religious or nominally religious families are getting swept up in religious fervor. This is creating a complicated and sometimes painful family dynamic. Now, you've got to have something of a smile on your face when you hear this, because usually when you hear about the generation gap, you're hearing about more conservative parents and more liberal kids, or you're talking about arguments over everything from tattoos to music. You're talking about adolescents who are supposedly showing some kind of rebellion against the norm, and adults who are supposed to be perplexed by that. But you got to smile about this one, because the tables are turned. Here you have the baby boomers and their heirs as parents who are largely secular and at least defined by these parents as nominally Christian, if they identify as Christian. And their own kids are far more committed than are they, teenagers in particular. Now, the Wall Street Journal's report looks not only at Christianity, but Orthodox Jews and also Muslims and others, where you have the same dynamic between parents and children. Our interest is what this has to say about the Christian church, about Christian parents, and about Christian young people. But I mentioned as I was speaking at the beginning of the program that this also has to do with where I live and what I do. I'm president of a seminary and a college where we train persons for Christian ministry and Christian leadership unapologetically. And at Boyce College and the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, we have thousands of young people who have committed their lives to a full-time Christian service around the world. And a frightening percentage of them would give the same testimony. Their parents aren't really sure why they're here. Their parents may not be supportive of the fact they've committed themselves to Christian ministry. Let me read a little bit more from the Wall Street Journal article. In this case, reporter Catherine Rossman tells the story of Kevin Elstrand, a 16-year-old Christian boy whose parents are, quote, self-described secular humanists. Kevin is serious about his Christian commitment. He's highly involved in Christian activities and Bible study. His parents are scared of his fervor, but he is scared that his parents are headed for hell. So very interesting dynamic here. At one point in the article, Kevin Elstrand's mom says that she's completely perplexed and obviously troubled by the fact that he doesn't buy the theory of evolution. This is a very strange family dynamic indeed. Let me read to you from the report. She says, in a time when many teens are having sex and taking drugs, his parents, that is Kevin's parents, mostly consider his piety a blessing. They get upset, however, when Kevin explains that he doesn't believe in evolution. To me, this is appalling, says his mother, Kevin Byers, who has a doctorate in strategic management and was raised a Methodist. We get into arguments, and voices get a little louder than they should. Kevin says, I don't want my parents to go to hell for not believing in God. That's what's going to happen, and it really scares me. Kevin's father, Alan Elstrand, director of MBA programs at the University of Arkansas Business School, says he respects his son but is saddened that he has such worries. I'm sorry, that's the byproduct of his religious studies, says Mr. Elstrand, who grew up Unitarian. Well, if you classically hold a Unitarian and Universalistic doctrine, then you're not concerned about anybody going to hell. But Kevin Elstrand, a 16-year-old, is very concerned that his parents are going to hell, and they're very concerned that he's concerned that they might go to hell. Now, this is an interesting phenomenon, but when you think about the fact that Christianity, when it first came into existence in the first century, faced many of the same things. This is why Jesus said, if you're unwilling to leave father and mother and sister and brother for the sake of the kingdom, then you're unworthy of the kingdom. It's because he is saying that allegiance to me is a higher allegiance even than a family allegiance. And he wasn't speaking here to minor children. He was speaking to adult converts to Christianity. But this is a reminder to us that the opportunity for family strife has always been there. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, the Apostle Paul has to deal with marriages in which one person makes a conversion, makes a commitment to Christ, experiences conversion to Christ, and the other spouse does not. We understand this can cause a tremendously complicated family context. That's exactly what Catherine Rosman is reporting on in their support for the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal is primarily the nation's business newspaper, but it also has a keen eye for the big changes in the culture that matter. And when the Wall Street Journal zeroes in on something like this, you can count on it being a big story. The pattern makes sense. These young people have had to swim against the tide ever since they identified as Christians. Many know almost nothing of the easy believism of their parents' generation. In other words, cultural Christianity is not really an option for adolescents and for young adults in this culture. It's largely disappeared. They understand cultural hostility to Christianity. They've made their commitment. There's no room for a half-hearted approach to the faith. I'm back to the article by Catherine Rosman. She says this: the issue is especially fraught in immigrant communities. Magdalena Ramos, 48, and her late husband came to Los Angeles from Honduras 24 years ago to provide economic opportunity for their children. Quote, every parent wants their child to have more money, says Mrs. Ramos, a housekeeper who didn't raise her son Abner with religion. During his sophomore year at the University of California at Los Angeles, that's UCLA, Abner declared that he had decided to devote his life to Christ. But she became disappointed when Abner decided to forego his plans of being a psychologist in favor of low-paying ministry work. Though Ms. Ramos says she is proud that her son is a good Christian, she had thought he would be the first person in the family with a professional career. He also had told her when he was a boy that he'd one day help support her. Says Abner, who is now 29, my mom's dreams for me are inconsistent with the callings God has for me. Now, this pattern is not specific to any ethnic group, of course. Several years ago, a campus minister at an evangelical institution told me that he was having trouble. He was having some feedback with parents of some of his students. They were upset. Now, what would possibly upset the parents of some of these students on his college campus? It's that so many of them were responding with commitments to ministry and missions in particular. He told of one particular couple who sat down with him in the president's office of the university to complain that their daughter had committed herself to missionary service. And the father said, I didn't spend $80,000 on my daughter's college education for her to go throw it all away in some godforsaken place on the mission field. Now, the weird thing is those parents thought themselves Christians. We're living in an interesting time. We're talking about the generational divide, indeed religion's generation gap. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. There are so many on the front lines of this particular dynamic. Not only are we talking about parents and their kids, we're also talking about youth ministers and pastors and campus ministers and others who are experiencing this. On this campus, I've had several young men say to me, when I announced to my family that I believed I was being called to the Christian ministry, they did not respond with respect. They did not respond with prayer and affirmation. They responded by saying, but look at what you're throwing away, an opportunity to go into medicine, an opportunity to go into law, an opportunity to make a lot of money, an opportunity to make yourself famous and a reputation. You know, where are we when the Wall Street Journal, of all media outlets, notices that we now have many young people who are far more committed to Christ, to Christianity, to the gospel, to the church, than are their own parents? The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. There are some who are trying to dismiss this as a new form of adolescent rebellion. But you know, it doesn't look like that argument's going to wash, because it looks like this particular pattern is carrying through into adulthood. We reap what we sow. And when in so many of our churches, we were sowing seeds of a very tepid and half-committed Christianity, it took in a generation, but it's not taking in their own children. We're talking about religion's generation gap. The Wall Street Journal's noticed it. I notice it. If you're a youth minister or a pastor, you see it. You may even have experienced some of this in your own home and with your own family. We'd love to hear about it. This is a place for intelligent Christian conversation. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Perhaps the child shall lead them. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back. We're talking about the religious generation gap. It's caught the attention of the Wall Street Journal, and it has our attention as well. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Sanford, Florida, where Vanessa's on the line. Go ahead, Vanessa.
Hi, yes. I just wanted to input that my 9-year-old daughter, through her, I found my church home. And then because of her devotion to the Lord and her true, honest, you know, just sincere love, that, you know, each day I find myself drawing closer to the Lord.
Well, that is a sweet testimony, Vanessa. Thank you for your call. You know, I think immediately of Jesus speaking of the little ones coming unto him and telling us that if we do not come with the faith of a child, then we do not come with the saving faith, that absolute trust and faith that must have been so beautifully displayed by your 9-year-old daughter. And I appreciate your testimony of how that was led, how the Lord used that to change your own heart, to draw you to the Lord as well. And even though in this particular article we're generally talking about children who are older, the same principle can apply here. I mean, we're talking about the fact that oftentimes we learn from our children, even some of the most important things spiritually, when it's the children who are more committed than we are. Let's go to Brett calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Brett.
Yes, I was just going to say I am a youth pastor here around the Louisville area, and it's just amazing. It's an awesome testimony to me that we have about 90% of our youth that I have to pick up in vans because they come and their parents don't. And it's just awesome testimony to Christian families who are out there witnessing in the schools and with their friends.
Brett, I appreciate your call. Let me ask you a direct question here. Are you seeing much of this, and I'm going to put you on the spot here a little bit, so don't name your church, but where you are serving, do you see some of this where sometimes the kids are more committed to Christ and to the church than are their parents?
Yes, very much so. I mean, we have a very small youth group. It's about 15 kids, and like I said, I mean, their parents are not Christians and don't really care to come to church, but they're just very involved in church. And I even have to pick them up in the van, but it's just a testimony to God's power.
Well, Brett, I appreciate your ministry to those teenagers, and you know, I'm praying that the Lord will use them to reach their parents. And that's what I first thought when I read this article in the Wall Street Journal, which begins by talking about Kevin Elstrand, the 16-year-old boy who's very committed as a Christian, very concerned that his parents are going to hell. You know, the Lord might use him as a way of reaching his own parents with the gospel. Thanks for your call, Brett. Let's go to Lauren, listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Lauren.
Yes, I just wanted to say that I'm a youth leader in my local church, and I work very closely with 25 teenagers, and I've had parents actually accuse us of brainwashing them at times because they were so involved and so sold out to the things of God, and their parents don't go to church, and they don't understand it. So I just think it's amazing how God is really using our teenagers.
And, Lauren, I think it's amazing that there will be parents who would complain that the church is being too effective in its ministry. Doesn't that perplex you?
Yeah, it is. It's very disturbing. I don't really understand how anyone could, you know, make such accusations when it's for the good of their child.
Yeah, well, I'm going to go out on a limb and speculate here, Lauren, and I think I'm on pretty firm ground in making this speculation. My guess is that these parents are largely convicted of their own tepid, half-hearted commitment to Christ when their children turn out to be much more committed. I think they are often embarrassed when their children are seen to be much more active in the church, much more excited about the things of God, much more convictional about Christian truth, much more committed to study the Bible, much more committed to sharing the gospel, and much more committed to living out what it means to be a Christian. I think that can be what this reporter calls a complicating family situation. I think it can be a complicating spiritual situation where this can really be convicting of parents. Thanks so much for your call, Lauren. It's great to hear from you. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Now, again, I see this on a regular basis. And as a matter of fact, when I first became president of this institution One of the first students I met was a young man who was kicked out of his house. Kicked out by his father because he made a commitment to Christian ministry. You know, that's not a new thing in the history of the Christian church. But I think in a lot of homes, it's a new thing for a family to experience. I think even when there are kids who aren't kicked out of the home, there are a lot of parents who are scratching their heads sometimes going, I wonder why he would choose this. You know, I hear it when I have a young person say to me, look, my dad said, why didn't you go into law? Why didn't you go into medicine? Why didn't you go into insurance, for that matter? What kind of money do you think you're going to make in Christian ministry? You know, the very thought that that's not what it's about tells you a great deal. And we'll be right back. As expected, this is a fascinating conversation. Lots of folks on the front lines here. You've got, obviously, parents and adolescents. And if you work with young people in churches, you definitely see this. And there are a lot of folks out there trying to figure this out. Do you think of Christian Smith and his colleagues at the University of Virginia in their book Soul Searchers, in which they're really looking at the fact that this is not primarily a rebellious generation of adolescents. Not at all. This is a generation of adolescents that when it comes to especially the deep spiritual, philosophical, ideological issues, they're likely to be more conservative than their parents. In this case, likely to be more devout in their Christian commitment than their parents. And this is creating an interesting family dynamic. It's an interesting challenge for ministers, youth ministers, and others as well. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We're going to go to John Day, Oregon, where Anna's on the line. Go ahead, Anna.
Hi, I believe as a parent of six children, I thought I was very Christian, but I am learning so much from one of my daughters that is here, and she's got so much faith. It's just unbelievable, and I think it's great.
Anna, that's such a sweet word. Tell me, how old are your children? What's the age range there?
I have 17 up to 25.
17 to 25. So you're talking about your kids being right in the age range of this Wall Street Journal article. That's fascinating. Now, just tell me, when you talk about learning Christian values from your kids, and you mentioned this one daughter, when she started showing this kind of deep Christian commitment, did this worry you?
No. Are you kidding? I hope that having her here, I'm going to learn so much more. I think that, you know, she has a lot to teach me.
Well, I appreciate your call, Anna. And, you know, this is just a reminder to us that the God's up to some surprising things in different places and different times. And sometimes the parents are reached through the kids. I think the deep underlying dynamic here is what's really fascinating to me. For so many years, the Christian church, and especially and particularly evangelical churches, tended to put out so little biblical content. Tended to dumb down the Christian faith so low, tended to minimize and lower the boundaries between belief and unbelief to such an extent that it is a situation which maybe many baby boomers just don't really consider Christianity to be all that big a deal. They weren't presented with the life-changing gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. They weren't presented with the stark alternatives of belief and unbelief. They weren't forced to understand the clear teachings of Christ, the demands of Christ. I think of John Piper's new book on the commands of Christ. He's gone through and isolated over 1,000 different commands spoken by Christ. I mean, just think about that. Here's this huge number of commandments that Jesus gives to his own people. And instead, what we have had in evangelical churches, far too many of these churches for far too long, is an easy believism of cultural Christianity. And this younger generation's not buying into that. They're not buying into it for two reasons. Negatively, they're not buying into it because they see nothing in it that's compelling. And positively, they're not buying into it because many of them are beginning to taste and see the authentic gospel and its life-changing power, and they don't want to settle for anything less. I often describe this generation, the generation that is now on our college and seminary campuses, the generation now on a lot of high school campuses, as a generation that's ready to do something radical. And unlike the children of the 60s, they're not really looking to do something radical to scandalize their parents. Many of them are looking to do something radical that will be pleasing to God. Now, that is going to create an interesting generational dynamic, and we're seeing this play out in all too many families. I hope this is a wake-up call for an awful lot of parents, dads and moms, to recover what it means to be serious Christian parents in order to raise serious Christian children, in order to teach them, as it is the parents' responsibility to teach and to serve as models. But here's the indictment, and it really is a severe indictment. In all too many cases, if the parents do not live up to this responsibility, in all too many cases, if the parents forfeit their responsibility, their children may rise up to be their judges. Their children may arise as more convictional, as more deeply committed, as more transformed by the gospel. And it's obvious that with a lot of these parents, there's just the embarrassment of knowing that their kids are so much more committed than are they. That their kids are going on the commitments to the mission field, and they're not. That their kids are looking at radically different lifestyles, and they're not. Their kids are looking at a radically reordered set of priorities, and they're not. No wonder this is leading to some strife. I feel especially for this boy that is in the article in the Wall Street Journal, Kevin Elstrand. And this is a young man, 16 years old, who really sees so much more clearly than do his parents. He sees that they are headed for hell. He sees them in their obstinate unbelief. He sees them in their secularism, and he is concerned for them. What 16-year-old would not respond in just this way if they saw the reality as clearly as Kevin Elstrand does? You know, the perfect picture is of parents who pray for the conversion of their children. And Christian parents, as soon as the child is conceived, as soon as they know that there is a child coming, should begin praying, or even before they even know they're pregnant, should be praying for the conversion of whatever children that God would give to the marriage. And then, of course, as the child comes to life and begins to grow, and as the child is taught, and the child begins to learn, and as the child begins to mature, the parent continues to pray that they will come to faith in Christ. And having made that commitment to faith in Christ, would grow in grace, grow in nurture, grow in favor with God and man, even as Christ is described in the Gospel of Luke as doing so. But the tables are really turned when it's the kids who are praying for the conversion of the parents. Something powerful is going on here. And I go back to the fact that if the Wall Street Journal thinks this is important, you can count on the fact it's important. The Wall Street Journal is the nation's business newspaper by and large, but they also are keen observers of the cultural scene. Some of their reporting is among the best in the nation. And when, in this case, reporter Catherine Rosman looked at the reality of kids who are more devout than their parents, she saw something that should catch the attention of the business and cultural leadership of this country. I think it ought to really catch the attention of the Christian leaders in this country. I think every pastor needs to be aware of this article. I think every pastor, youth minister, and every parent needs to be aware of this dynamic. We need to recognize that, as we so often are reminded in Scripture, as we sow, so shall we reap. With that in mind, we can see the reaping of a generation of half-hearted Christians, often in their adulthood, and for that matter, even secular persons who show no evidence of belief in Christ at all. But along comes a generation that appears to be somewhat different, several, many of whom are deeply committed to Christ. Folks, any way you look at it, that's good news. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. We're talking here on a Monday afternoon, and here in Louisville, Kentucky, it's a spectacularly beautiful day. It's just a hint of the fact that spring is coming. The sky is blue. The sun is shining. It's hard to believe that several days ago, just to our south, a devastating series of tornadoes and thunderstorms went through Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Georgia, and into South Carolina. In Enterprise, Alabama, the tornadoes came through a high school, and 8 young people, all of them aged 16 and 17 years old, were killed. 8 young people, eight teenagers. We've been talking about this generational divide and how so many of these young people are deeply committed to Christ in this generation. It's interesting to look at the pictures of the eight young people, and it's hard not just to call them children who were killed in this tornado. It's such a sad story because the tragedy was not even apparent to so many people as it was happening. Interviews with people who had been in other parts of the high school there in Enterprise, Alabama, say they were unaware that the tornado had done any major damage until they saw persons with great injuries coming down the hallway saying that people had been killed. And in this case, the people included these eight teenagers. I could not help but notice that one of them had the same name as my own, spelled exactly the same way. I was struck by the fact it could well have been one of my children taken by such a storm. And just in light of that tragedy, my heart immediately goes out to those parents. Also, our hearts go out to the parents of those young baseball players killed in the bus accident almost the same day there in metropolitan Atlanta. It's a reminder to us that time is a lot shorter than we'd like to think. We look at the pictures of those teenagers in Enterprise, Alabama, and they look so incredibly healthy. One of the young men, well, his father said of him, he was strong as an ox. Well, you know what? Being 17 and strong as an ox is no match for a tornado. Life is short. And one of the things we need to remember when we're talking about this generational gap, this religion gap that exists between some parents and some children, is that the time is very short to preach Christ. The time is very short. The Bible is very clear that today is the appointed day of salvation. It's very easy for us to assume, especially when we look to young people, that we'll always have an opportunity to reach them. We'll always have an opportunity to tell them about Christ. We'll always have an opportunity to finally get serious about the things of God with our own young people. There are eight families in Enterprise, Alabama, who know very differently now. They know that they'll never have that opportunity. Some of those funeral and memorial services are being held today, others tomorrow. Also, funeral services for the baseball players killed. Let's remember to pray for families that are grieving, and let's pray that through this pain, there will be an opening for the gospel of Jesus Christ. I'll meet you tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. This is the Albert Mohler Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.